Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, I will be playing part two of my interview with InQtel's Chief Security Officer, Dan Gear. That's all about machine learning in InfoSec. Is it actually going to turn into something, or is it just another InfoSec thought bubble? That is coming up in this week's feature after the news. This week's sponsor interview is with Dan Guido of Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits is a New York-based security engineering and testing company that does very interesting work, actually. They don't just break stuff, they actually work on securing stuff as well. And with that in mind, Dan's team has been looking at implementing control flow integrity protections into various software projects. So we speak to him about the LLVM versus Microsoft Control Flow Guard approach, you know, which one of those is achievable. And we also speak to him about Maxema, a tool that Trail of Bits developed, which reverses binaries into an intermediate language. And, you know, you can decompile Apache with this thing, recompile it with different options, and it will still serve pages. It works. So that's, you know, very useful for fuzzing and doing a whole bunch of stuff. That's really interesting stuff, and it's coming up later. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news. And oh boy, we got lots of news to talk about. And Adam, first cab off the rank this week is Google has decided that Symantec is very naughty. No biscuits for Symantec. They're de-trusting Symantec. What the hell?
Yeah, this is the biggest shakeup I guess we've seen in a very long time of the like, centralized certification authority PKI infrastructure, and the Google Chrome team are going to kick Symantec to the curb. I mean, not completely boot them out of the trust store, but they are effective immediately removing Symantec's ability to issue extended validation certs. The EV certs that are A, very expensive, B, VeriSign's core business in the certificate market space, and C, kind of a big deal for anyone who's in the banking, or in industries where EV certs and the nice little green padlock you get instead of the regular padlock is seen as an important thing.
Interesting that you said that, because I find this a little bit rich coming from the Chrome team, given that the difference between an EV cert and a shitty free DV cert from Let's Encrypt, you know, like, it's very hard for an average user to even spot the difference between those two things. And now they're detrusting EV. It's like, why don't you fix your interface first, guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, the difference between EV certs and what assertions those EV certs actually make is lost, as you say, on essentially everybody other than people who, you know, work in this industry, perhaps. So, yeah, that is a, you know, it's not.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm really enjoying seeing Symantec experience pain, right? Like, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, it just seems an odd step to be so rigid about this sort of stuff when your interface sucks so bad, bad.
And I think, you know, to a certain extent, everybody's interface for explaining PKI to the average user sucks, because it's just we haven't thought of a good way to doing it in general. The other thing that they are doing is that they are going to reduce the length of time which Symantec certificates and all of Symantec's family of CA certificates are valid for, which, once again, this doesn't seem like a particularly big punishment, given that it just means that Symantec will be able to collect more money reissuing those certs for a smaller time period. So not perhaps super effective. But they're going to roll out over the period of the next two or three releases of Chrome a gradual decrease in the maximum lifetime for which a Symantec signed cert can be issued. All of this has come about because of people looking into the kind of certificate transparency logs that are now coming out of Symantec in the light of some of the certificates they've misissued in the past. Google is claiming something like 30,000 bad certificates or certificates for domains that they weren't authorized to issue were generated, presumably covering some of the Google properties, which is one of the reasons they've come out with such a big stick. Symantec's arguing that wasn't actually the case, that it was less than that, but either way, Google has thrown them into the dog box, and we'll see whether any of the other browser vendors or people who maintain trust stores, you know, the OS vendors, do follow suit.
Well, I mean, not only are they saying that it was less than 30,000, they're saying that it was 127 certificates,
which is quite a bit less.
Quite a bit less than 30,000, yes. Look, what's your take on this? Because I just think, as much as I'd like to see the CA scene shaken up, I mean, is this the way to do it?
Well, that is a really good question. I mean, the EV certs were meant to be the thing that made what the CAs were doing more valuable and actually, you know, useful to any extent at all. Whereas the, you know, the sort of the likes of Let's Encrypt, or we were heading down the road of, you know, for a little while of having DNSSEC backed Dane certificate infrastructure rather than a CA backed infrastructure. And that that would mean that there was sort of a difference between those that are domain control validated and those that are actually validated through some, you know, external process that looks at, you know, business records or whatever. And that was kind of the point of the EV certs. And I don't know, as you pointed out, that EV certs have really made any difference. And so, you know, kind of shaken up the cert industry by booting out, you know, what is something like 40% of the market. Because, I mean, Symantec's made so many acquisitions over the years.
Yeah, I mean, VeriSign being the big one, right?
VeriSign. But yeah, I mean, it really is quite a big stick to wave around. And I guess that, like, how big a stick that is illustrated by the fact that they haven't just booted them out completely. Like, that there's a phased kind of lowering of lifetimes rather than just booting them out. And, you know, if any other CA, like WoSign, for example, what was the most recent one that got thrown out of the root store by Chrome? You know, if it was anyone smaller than VeriSign, would they have given them that kind of grace? I don't know. So maybe Symantec are still too big to fail in the PKI space. I don't know.
Well, maybe this is how you enact change, by taking aim squarely at the biggest provider and just saying, boom, you're gone, right? So I think this is really going to hit Symantec in the hip pocket because, you know, if you're working on the web team for some bank, I mean, you're not going to go get a VeriSign certificate again, are you? I mean, this will be costing them money immediately.
Yeah, I imagine it will hit them very squarely in the wallet. And whether that results in a meaningful change in terms of their behavior, I don't know. I mean, Google said that they will have this will be the case for the minimum of a year. So no matter what Symantec does, they're not going to get the ability to sell EV certs back that are trusted by Google within the next year. So yeah, that is definitely going to, I mean, those things are real expensive. So yeah, it is going to cost them real revenue.
Some interesting developments in the United States. Congress has apparently just passed an act that will allow ISPs to basically just monitor the crap out of their users and then sell that data off to whoever.
Yeah, this is, I guess, not a particularly reassuring thing if you're an American ISP user. There's been sort of some previous controls in terms of what data your ISP could share or having to have your consent, you know, the sort of privacy legislation that first world countries have. And yeah, it looks like they're going to allow the ISPs to just kind of use that data willy-nilly without any requirement for the users to opt in or consent or that kind of thing. I mean, you would kind of hope that if they're making that much money selling your data that they would give you, I don't know, a reduced price or something, that there would be some trade-off where you could opt for a cheaper service in return for having all of your data sold to everybody. And it really does sound like it is actually a lot of data. I mean, like, what stuff you're looking up by the DNS, clear text HTTP traffic, kind of what sites you're visiting. Like, it just seems really, like a really bad idea to then go and provide that willy-nilly to marketers. But, I mean, I guess that's, you know, they want to compete with Google in the advertising market, and that's, I guess, what they got to do.
Oh, now a very interesting story from Forbes here, Adam. Last year, of course, we spent a bunch of time discussing the attacks against, banks through their, you know, SWIFT terminals and whatever. The Bank of Bangladesh, the Central Bank of Bangladesh, of course, lost a whole bunch of money in those attacks. It looks increasingly likely that North Korea was actually behind these attacks. And when you think about it, it does make an awful lot of sense, given the way that the money was moved around in this sort of, you know, money exfil stage of these attacks against banks. But yeah, interesting. Indictments could be coming soon.
Yeah, no, it's certainly an interesting twist to the story. I mean, I think we talked about it maybe at the time that, you know, it sounded like it could be the North Koreans, haha. But yeah, it actually, if, you know, the US are preparing to point that finger, that is definitely an interesting plot twist. And of course, we've seen a bunch of information subsequent to the Bangladeshi hack of other banks being hit in the SWIFT department. And apparently some of those intrusions were using very similar tools and techniques, which, you know, suggests that North Koreans were involved in a fairly kind of large scale intent to steal a whole bunch of money from banks. And you got to ask, I guess, if you're North Korea, well, why not? Like, yeah, what are they going to do? Call the police on you? They're already under so many sanctions already that, yeah, there's probably not a whole bunch of downsides for them to, you know, stealing $1 billion here and there.
Yeah, well, they used to even run ships full of heroin into Australia. I mean, people can Google for the Pong Su incident that was around 2003. So North Korea sort of does look like it's run by the Soprano family. Basically, that's kind of how they roll. Moving on to Ars Technica now, and this story's been carried by a bunch of outlets. WikiLeaks dumped a whole bunch more of, you know, more CIA information And you know, the most recent dump sort of looks at where at what the CIA was doing to subvert Macs through like Thunderbolt attacks. It looks like these attacks were based on public research presented at Black Hat by some shadowy character named Snare.
Ah, yes, that shadowy, sneaky underground Black Hat Snare. Yes, he showed up at Black Hat 2012 and gave a talk about his research into pre-boot compromise of Macs through like kind of like Trojan option ROMs on Thunderbolt connected Ethernet adapters. And yeah, sure enough, directly after that, the CIA developed the same technique. Wonder how that happened.
Yeah, wonder how they put that together. You know, what's really funny about this, and of course, you know, the journalists writing this up don't know this, but Snare actually works for Apple.
Yeah, just recently actually started over there. And I'm sure he'll be working on something very, very interesting that he's not allowed to talk about.
Yeah, because that's how they roll. I think they're more secretive than the CIA, right? They leak less.
Well,
so
clearly, yeah, they do leak less.
But the WikiLeaks dump also shows, you know, a bit of info on CIA interdiction of the iPhone supply chain, which is kind of interesting. So, you know, if you're planning, you know, if you're a Bond villain, maybe don't order online via the Apple store, I think is the moral of the story.
Yeah, I think recommendation is go into the physical store and buy one for cash. That's the recommended approach.
Yes, so that's more info in this week's show notes. Now, look, we've got a couple of really interesting stories here from, of all places, Voice of America, which has taken another look at the CrowdStrike report, not into the DNC hacks, but there was a report they did afterwards talking about the subversion of an Android app that was used to calculate artillery equipment settings that was used by the Ukrainian military. And obviously some group, gee, I wonder who, had got in there, Trojaned it, and it was sending information back to them. And, you know, it was a very interesting story. Looks like they might have actually overreached on a couple of elements of that, which, given how serious the CrowdStrike report into the DNC stuff needs to be taken, I'm sort of surprised this story isn't picking up more traction, because it certainly looks like CrowdStrike did overreach in that report about the Trojaned artillery app, so much so that since this Voice of America story broke, they've actually walked back a couple of sections of that report.
Yeah, so I mean, the claims that are being disputed here are not that the artillery app was compromised. It was compromised, apparently. That bit hasn't been changed, and it was the same kind of variety of implant that we've seen Fancy Bear use elsewhere. But what they, some of the claims that they made around the impact of that compromise in terms of the number of Ukrainian artillery units that were destroyed or that went away, some of those claims have been walked back. CrowdStrike had based their assessment of impact on the numbers, the change in numbers of Ukrainian artillery, which came from a study from the International Institute of Strategic Studies, which said that, you know, there had been quite a significant change, and particularly in that type, or that type of artillery that they used that software for. And now the original authors of that report have said, you know, actually the change in numbers was something entirely different and not related to combat losses. So yeah, they've kind of walked back that aspect of the impact, which doesn't change so much of the assertion that there was a compromised app, but it does change sort of the overall meaning of the report. And yeah, as you say, they do need to be very careful drawing conclusions when their reports are such an important part of the kind of geopolitics now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not marketing anymore, guys. You know, let's just take this a little bit more seriously. And it might sound cool, but you know, I mean, they pick up the phone next time. You know, don't just rely on some data and infer from that. You know, don't take a bit of a leap because it makes your report look more cool, because this stuff is important.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, funny tweet here, actually, from Michael Kosiarski, which was that he pointed out that FedEx is actually offering customers like a $5 voucher to re-enable Flash. And there's this page where it sort of, you know, tells people how to bypass all of the, you know, like in Chrome where it's disabled it, or Safari or whatever. Like, here's how you turn it back on and we'll give you a $5 voucher. That's interesting, right? But it's becoming a bit of a trend, because if we look at this other story here from Krebs on Security, eBay is now asking people not to use hardware key fobs. They're asking them to use SMS 2FA, which Krebs asserts is a downgrade in security, but I don't know about that, because, you know, hardware key fobs, they're fishable anyway. But it is interesting, right, that instead of moving with the times, you know, we've got this situation where companies are kind of struggling to keep up and sort of offering carrots to their users to do the least ideal thing.
Yeah, no, certainly the paper one is kind of interesting. I mean, whether a 10-year-old VeriSign token is better than SMS auth. I mean, that might be arguable. I mean, SMS obviously has its challenges, and we did see.
Look, I'm sure the fine folks at eBay and PayPal ran the numbers, right? Like, they would have looked at this and they would have gone, okay, well, we might get a little bit of fraud here, but they'll cover it, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's significantly cheaper to do SMS than it is to deal with hardware key fobs and that kind of thing.
Mm. Oh, Microsoft had a bit of drama this week as well. There was this docs.com, docs.com service, which started to look a little bit more like docs.com, actually, after they launched it. Am I right? So they had this thing where you could search public documents. The problem was a lot of the people who were publishing their documents through this service didn't actually know that these documents would be public. So there was all sorts of private information in there. And I think they actually wound up pulling the pin on the thing.
Yeah, apparently there was like some integration between it and like it's kind of part of the Office 365 family, and people didn't realize that the privacy settings meant default share. And yeah, Microsoft apparently initially pulled the search functionality from the front page and then subsequently pulled the search functionality from elsewhere in the site. It's now come back, but of course a bunch of this stuff got indexed by the search engines, including Bing, which apparently is a search engine that exists. And yeah, people are being somewhat embarrassed by having, mypasswords.xls easily accessible to everybody.
For those who are interested in the latest numbers around patch levels involving the Android ecosystem, Andy Greenberg has written up a story on that for Wired. So take a look at that. He writes it up as Android's huge security problem is getting less huge, but I don't know, because I flipped through the numbers in this article and I'm like, well, actually, it still looks pretty bad. By less huge, I mean like maybe incrementally less huge, but it's still pretty huge. Hot on the heels of that, we've got this other story from Ars, which talks about how Android really sucks at randomizing MAC addresses. I mean, this was something that was introduced, iOS was the first to do it. It was something that was introduced into Android, but it looks like it hasn't been implemented far and wide because something like only 6% of devices, Android devices, actually do bother randomizing MACs.
Yeah, and even when they do, they still send out probe requests with their real Mac periodically anyway. That's kind of defeating the point. Really not a great implementation. There is actually also discussion in that article of an active technique for kind of like decloaking the randomized MAC addresses, which wasn't one I was familiar with. So that's quite a cool thing. If you're into wireless pen testing, have a read of that bit.
Ars also reports that there is a bit of a campaign targeting iOS users, and we don't often see stuff targeting iOS users, in the wild. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, there was a bug in like the mobile Safari where you could kind of get into an infinite loop with a pop-up dialog box. Someone was using it with like a, you've been looking at porn, please pay a fine to unlock your device, via prepaid iTunes gift cards to the police. Otherwise, you can't continue to use it because of this infinitely popping up, modal dialog, which, yeah, kind of smooth, I guess. I don't know how much money they got out of it.
But it's an interesting way to weaponize, an annoying bug, which is almost like kind of
DOS, it's very, right? Like good lateral thinking.
Yeah, nice lateral thinking. Well done. We spoke briefly last week about how Tavis is having a crack at password managers again. LastPass, OnePassword, whatever, and he's just banging away at them. It's good to see, actually, and it is only going to make them better. And I'm really quite relieved that his commentary around it has got much more measured.
Yeah, he posted. Although he did post on Twitter that he had an idea for a remote code exec in LastPass in the shower the other morning, and it turns out, yep, sure enough, remote code exec in LastPass. So that's kind of funny. And I guess the thing, one of the things we can take away from Tavis's kind of crusade against the password managers is that all of the password managers that have integration with the browsers are a bad idea, and the ones where you actually kind of cut and paste by hand, kind of a whole bunch less to go wrong. Maybe that's the right approach.
Maybe that's the way to go, yeah. Yeah. Interesting info on APT29, which is, of course, Cozy Bear. Someone's taken a bit of a look at some of the, APT29's malware and found that it was using domain fronting, which is kind of a cool way to roll if you want some stealthy CNC.
Yeah, it is. The FireEye guys have been doing a few talks. It was one of the kind of a B-sides, actually, and where we just came from in Canberra a couple of weeks ago, about this kind of domain fronting as a way to, make it complicated to spot command and control traffic on the network. In this particular case, they were running a traffic reflector on Google's AppSpot, kind of hosted app service. So on the network, it was going to Google, had certs from Google, and then it was actually forwarding it onwards to a Tor kind of entry point, and then they were doing their command and control over Tor, which is quite a smooth way of operating.
It is, isn't it? I mean, that's that's why I pulled this one. You know, like there's plenty of malware analysis published every week, but I saw this and I just thought, that's pretty smooth, right? Like, good luck spotting it.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely a good option if you're looking for a way to do these things. And there's loads of places for proxying stuff through them. And FireEye guys were talking about one that was using like Google Translate as a way to pass data back and forward to arbitrary URLs that looked like it was Google on the client end. Which, yeah, that's just clever. That's good stuff.
It is good stuff. Nicely done, Russia. Now, last week we spoke about this person, unknown party, who's trying to shake down Apple for like $75,000. In like gift cards or Bitcoin or whatever you have, or peanuts, or I don't even know. But they were saying they had millions of breached, you know, iCloud credentials. A bunch of people now are saying they don't have a million, you know, like iCloud credentials. They're actually lying through their teeth. So, you know, this Turkish crime family group, you know, a lot of people are calling bullshit on this, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be, and Troy Hunt and a few other people have been opining based on what they've seen of some of the iCloud data in the data sets, that it's probably from password reuse from other breaches then being tried against Apple properties, and then those are the ones that they're using to try and convince Apple that they have a massive cache when in fact they don't.
Now this is a fun one from Motherboard. Someone who has been charged with, child exploitation offences because they, you know, they were using Tor and they got FBI, you know, network investigative techniqued, right? and decloaked that way, and now they're being charged. Their lawyer has taken the creative approach of saying, well, that sort of child exploitation material might have been planted there by the government. So, you know, what we'd like to do is subpoena these documents that WikiLeaks has alluded to, you know, these CIA documents that WikiLeaks has alluded to, because they contain proof that it's possible to stealthily implant, you know, incriminating material on my client's hard drive. And of course, the DOJ has had to come out and say, well, those documents are classified, so, you know, too bad, you can't introduce them, which has inadvertently confirmed that the documents are genuine, because the DOJ can't claim something's classified unless they own it. So that's a fun little weird circuitous route to where we are.
Yeah, fell into a little legal punji pit there, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's just, it's fun, right? Like, Motherboard have written it up as like, oh, they've actually confirmed the CIA, you know, WikiLeaks dump. But it's like, we kind of knew it was genuine anyway. But,
well, yeah,
you know, still fun. Now, look, this is the skateboarding dog story for the end of the news. And it's my favorite of the week, which is, it turns out there's these Mealy dishwashers that have web servers on them, because that's the sort of thing that happens in 2017. And you can actually ...... your way to the shadow file on the dishwasher. So you can actually own a Mealy dishwasher with ...... which is like hella, makes me feel hella nostalgic. But
it does, doesn't
to a degree, like, this is actually a legit problem when you've got stuff on your network that's this bad.
Yeah, and these are not like residential dishwashers. These are like commercial, like hospital, like sterilizing dishwashers that they use. So they're kind of serious business equipment. Ethernet port on the back of those plugged into the network. Apparently, Dan Tentler found one on the internet somewhere that was actually live. There's no suggestion that he actually shelled it. But yeah, it's just not good enough, and it really isn't.
No, it isn't. But it's been a hell of an opportunity for the guys and gals at Senrio, right? So we're actually doing the soapbox thing, which is pretty promotional for them in a couple of days, so people can hear about that. But my God. And it's actually something that Stephen says in this soapbox thing that we got coming up, which is because they've done a lot of consulting on device security and stuff, and it's never like code exec. Like, it's never memory corruption that owns these things. It's because they've got some service there that you just send commands to and they execute. So do you know what I mean? Like, fixing this, you're never going to be able to fix these devices on your network. You just have to deal with the fact that there's all these vulnerable things on your network.
And deal with it some way that involves them not getting shelled and not, it's just, everything's awful. Everything, internet is shit. Everything's awful.
Well, on that cheery note, Adam, that is it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. And well, I'm not sure if we're going to chat next week, because I did have leave scheduled for next week because I've got a visiting relative wanted to go camping, but we got this huge cyclone up in Queensland right now, which is a long way from me. I'm perfectly safe and all of that, but it's going to dump a whole bunch of rain on my region next week. So maybe I'll work next week and we'll do next week's show, and I'll take the week after that off because it will be sunnier. So maybe talk to you next week.
All right. Well, maybe I shall.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now. This is part two of my chat with Dan Gear. Part one ran last week, so if you missed that, do go back and have a listen to it. Dan is InQtel's chief security officer. InQtel is essentially the investment arm of the US intelligence community, a community that is very interested in machine learning and its applications. So I thought Dan would be the perfect person to speak to about machine learning concepts. The thing about Dan is he's really good at predicting future trends in InfoSec. He's a bit of a foreteller of interesting events, this guy. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of work done over the last decade in taking machine learning concepts and making them practical. Given we're in the big data age, it's something that's become huge in the intelligence community, and it's also rushing headlong into the InfoSec space, and it's assisting in everything from malware classification to optimizing SIEM outputs. There's just two examples. It seems like every security company, though, every security company now is claiming that their products make use of machine learning. Some of it's useful and some of it is, I promise you, woo. So I asked Dan what he thinks of machine learning in InfoSec, and here's what he said.
Without revealing anything about any little company that I might know something about, I will say that there are a lot of people trying to do just what you said. That is, I'm going to reinvigorate my market by not only building a good product, but getting building a good product that learns from its own experience. And it's hard to argue with that as a dream. It really is. I mean, what makes people who grow up to do great things, what makes that case? And almost all of them, if they ever get around to writing a biography, will say, you know, it really helped me that I was crushed here, here, and here because I was better for it. You know, that kind of story is so commonplace. And in a way, all the cybersecurity companies, you know, it's funny when people, you know, something I often say at the start of a speech or something, and I mean this, is that, you know, because I'll get introduced as, well, he's been at this a long time. And I'll say, you know, you heard a minute ago that I've been at this a long time. Your next question should be, well, why haven't you solved it yet? And that's exactly the case. We've been at this a long time and we haven't solved it yet. So we do need something that is a better way of approaching this. And it might well be that the diversity argument that we were having in so many words a minute ago might be part of it. It might well be allowing autonomy to proceed.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's potential here for this to be genuinely, and I hate to use a Silicon Valley word, but it could be genuinely disruptive, right?
So let me ask you the hardest question I know in that space, and that is, are we willing to let machines, I use the word machines, I know it sounds like science fiction, I don't know what else to use. Are we going to let machines make decisions that we can't understand?
Mm. And well, I'd argue that in some of the basic ways that machine learning is already being deployed in malware classification, we're already in that situation.
Yes,
they flag
we are.
Various
exactly
things
right.
And
exactly
we don't know
right.
why.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say in so many words, and we're already there in many ways. There's here in the context of this interview, I'm going to forget his name, which is embarrassing. There is a researcher at Oxford who I have corresponded with from time to time, who used a word which I believe is an Oxford word for this, and that is, will the algorithm retain interrogatability? Once you allow an algorithm to be self-modifying, the question is, can you still ask it, why did you make this decision? And if the answer is you can no longer get out of it a coherent answer to why did you decide to do that, you now only have one choice, and that is, do you trust it or not? And that's an interesting problem. That's a very interesting problem.
Well, and it becomes a great deal more interesting when you start looking at the fact that if you can enumerate a machine learning brain, you can start to fiddle with it in very subtle ways that a human wouldn't notice. And the machine indeed doesn't notice either, because once you know how it makes decisions, you can start fooling it into, certainly in the case of binary classifications, whether something is malicious or not. You know, you can mess with it and you'll never know that that's happened.
You'll never know. Once you trust the machine's reasoning and are comfortable with the idea that you can't understand it, at that point it's a little hard to argue that you're still in charge.
It is.
Now, at the same time, there were a couple of law professors, a summer and a half ago or something like that, who wrote an interesting law review article talking about how there's no reason to imagine that computerized traders, you know, people who trade stocks or bonds or whatever, that computerized traders who are possessed of machine learning capabilities, there's no reason to believe that they would not invent collusion. And how would you detect that? Would it be harder or easier than collusion amongst people? And their conclusion, by the way, was it'd probably be harder than detecting collusion amongst people.
They might just sort of evolve to realize that if they collude, they can take us, take money out of our pockets, basically, right? I mean, it's a fascinating idea.
If you and I agree to set prices for something and we control slightly over 50% of the market, we can pretty much make a lot of cash. You know, I mean, and their argument was roughly that it is inevitable that controlling a market, cornering a market, however you want to put it, collusively gaining control, can happen by chance. And if it happens by chance, it will be rewarded in a machine learning situation in the sense of they do whatever their measure of success, whatever advances their measure of success. It's just like evolution in that sense. And how would you detect that? And frankly, if you want to start writing really hard stuff, you can probably say, should robots pay taxes? Can they be guilty of crimes? You know, on and on and on. And I'm sure that's been explored thoroughly in the science fiction literature, which I'm almost completely unfamiliar with. But we are sort of getting there now, And in particular, my unnamed colleague at Oxford, his comment that preserving interrogatability for self-modifying algorithms is the research grade question of the day. And I bet he's right.
Yeah, but there's almost two ways that you can slice and dice this conversation. And that's why I find it such an interesting one. So there is that macro view of almost the philosophical analysis of, well, when we don't really understand how it makes its decisions, can we trust it? And then there's other people like, I speak to various technologists who are in this space, and they say, actually, it's pretty easy, because something that critics ignore is that it's quite easy to apply human intervention. You know, if you measure that your decision tree has gone wrong somehow, which in the case of something like malware prevention is fairly easy to do, because all of a sudden, you know, your secondary detection mechanisms are picking it up.
Sure. There's a concrete outcome.
So you know something's gone wrong. Then you can sort of go back and fiddle with it and take care of it pretty easily. And I think one of the problems with machine learning is we don't know from where to start. Do we start with the philosophical macro discussion, or do we start with the, hey, this is actually kind of simple, we're just trying to make binary classifications on stuff that humans find pretty mundane, so therefore machine learning is the perfect solution? So, you know, how do we begin to understand where we approach this from?
I am sure that machine learning can beat me at most anything I know how to do. You know, to be honest. I mean, if it can beat the world's chess players, it can beat the world's Go players, it can, you know, so forth and so forth. I'm sure anything that I know how to do, it can probably beat. At the moment, I could probably judge how well it was doing, but there'll probably come a time where I couldn't anymore judge it. Is that okay? And is there a reason to say we want to preserve it? Let me say, I was once trained as a statistician, so let me be a minor copy of a statistician for just a second. If you are building a model and your purpose of that model is to understand causality, then you want the model to have as few variables as possible. In other words, parsimony is your God. You want it to have as few variables as possible, because at the end of the modeling process, the coefficients in your equation tell you all you need to know about causality. On the other hand, if what you're trying to do is control, not causality, but control, then you just as soon have as many variables as you can lay hands on. And as long as you don't pay attention to the coefficients in the equation, that is all well and good. And you see that in economics all the time. Econometric models that have 1,000 variables. Well, what is the contribution to any one of them? And the answer is don't ask, because there's no way to tell.
Well, that seems to be malware classification based on machine learning seems to be very similar, you know. We've got 17 million properties that we're looking at, and darned if we know like how each one contributes, but seems to work pretty well.
Right. That's the point. That's exactly the point. Thank you. You made the point. That's exactly it. If it is okay that you get good control and you're comfortable with the idea, I get good control, but I don't know why, then there's no question about what the machine learning is a good thing, and the more of it, the better.
Hmm. I think, you know, where it gets complicated, of course, is when we start looking at things like military applications using drones that might be able to identify threats.
Sure,
you know, that's where it gets a little more life and death outside of InfoSec.
If I know that your apparatus, whether you're talking about InfoSec or you're talking about the military or whatever, is constantly learning from data, then my main job is to feed you bad data.
Hmm.
That is my main job because, amongst other things, if I feed you bad data, your program will work, quote, correctly, unquote. I think, by the way, we're moving from a world in which the classic confidentiality, integrity, availability triad for computer security, I think confidentiality is being eclipsed to a degree. I think we're now, that isn't our top priority. I think our top priority is now integrity and the dependence of algorithms that learn from data is part of that. And the other fact, of course, is that, you know, speaking sort of snidely, the general public has decided that they'll give up data in exchange for convenience. Not a problem.
Hmm.
So I don't think that confidentiality still holds the pinnacle position in the question of data security. I think data security is now integrity, not as much confidentiality. And integrity also follows along the lines of the same discussion we've been having, that is to say that if there's only one copy of the data, is that guaranteed right or is it guaranteed wrong, or would it really be nice to have two or three, and if they all agree that we're still okay?
Hmm.
You know, it's the same phenomenon. But I do think integrity wins.
Just sticking with you know, machine learning specifically, I'm guessing that you would have had a look at adversarial machine learning, at gaming it by poisoning, as you say, feeding it bad data. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to actually just, you know, try to enumerate it and then navigate a path through that thing's very complicated decision tree so that you can do bad stuff. Based on what you've seen when it comes to studies into adversarial machine learning, do you think this is a problem that can be overcome dependent on the application, or do you think that this stuff really just does fall apart when someone picks at it?
I think it'll be case by case basis.
Yeah.
I really do. In a way, we're talking about the idea that we have in InfoSec of fuzzing something as a testing mechanism. You know, why can't we extend that idea to, you know, I'm going to feed this thing bad data. If it still gets the right answer, then I've got a pretty resilient algorithm. If I feed it bad data and it gets the wrong answer, well, I've just done what amounts to a sensitivity test that of how sensitive it is to bad data. And, you know, we do that to discover parsing errors, for example. We fuzz things to see if they've got parsing errors. Maybe there's a metaphor there that we need to think about.
Mm. Dan Gear, thank you so much for joining us on the program again. It's been way too long and it's been fascinating. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're entirely welcome.
That was Dan Gear there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dan Guido, the big cheese at Trail of Bits. Now, Trail of Bits is a very interesting company. They do testing and, you know, stuff like that, sure. But they also do security engineering. They did a bunch of work on OS query for Facebook, among other things. But the idea is they don't just break stuff, they build it as well. So if you need some serious security engineering talent, you know, getting in touch with Trail of Bits is probably a good idea. Now, Dan is a big believer in eating his own dog food when it comes to actually understanding the recommendations Trail of Bits makes to clients. Often they'll say things like, hey, you should implement some sort of control flow integrity protection into your apps to mitigate things like ROP payloads. The thing is, there are a bunch of ways to do that, and they're not all easy. So Dan's team set about using two competing approaches, LLVM control flow integrity and Microsoft's control flow guard. As you'll hear, the results varied.
So we've been recommending that people turn on control flow integrity on their software projects for ages now, but we never actually looked into the details of what work that entails. So we had a great opportunity with OS Query. It's a multi-platform, large C++ code base, works on Linux and Windows. So we could compare and contrast the approaches that the LLVM development team, aka in this case, Google contributed this feature, took versus the approach that the Microsoft Visual Studio people took with Control Flow Guard. So applying this to OS Query was very revealing, since it taught us the kind of cascading effects of seemingly small design decisions, where it was very easy for us to apply Control Flow Guard, but very hard for us to apply Control Flow Integrity.
So does that mean that really, if you're going to use this approach, you know, more with the LLVM approach, that you need to actually develop your projects with this in mind from the ground up? Is it sort of impractical to retrofit?
Yeah, it does get pretty difficult. There are certain methods that people have used to develop software. Like, we tried to apply this on StrongSwan. Some people might be familiar with our Algo VPN project, which has gotten a little bit of hype over the last few days with all this mess in Congress. But we wanted to create a more secure version of StrongSwan that takes advantage of control flow integrity. But turning it on is basically impossible without rewriting that entire code base. So these are opportunities for us to learn about these technologies as we go through making better, more precise recommendations to our clients. And we were really happy to get the opportunity to do it with OS Query. And now I think we're in the better position to do it should we, you know, have the opportunity in the future.
Now, when it came to Control Flow Guard, which is Microsoft's approach, I mean, from, you know, we had a bit of a chat before we started recording, and basically, if I understand what you said correctly, it's really easy to turn on, but it doesn't quite get you as far as the LLVM approach.
Yeah. So with this general class of protections, Control Flow Integrity, Control Flow Guard, what they do is they ensure that what the developer thought the program would do in source code is what the program does at runtime. And that protects against things like return oriented programming and other kinds of code injection attacks and redirecting control flow as the program is executing.
So this is almost like going back to your first ever, you know, software course when you had to do the state machine for the traffic light controller. I don't know if they make you do that in America, but it's sort of like that, like actually imposing, you know, like a more strict state enforcement on the software. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. And in the control flow integrity sense, they actually enforce that the only places that your program can go are kind of encoded at compile time, and they have to have exactly the same arguments and the same return values, and those are all checked when the program is running. With control flow guard, it's a little bit weaker. It doesn't check to make sure that it's the exact right function. It just has a database of all the functions that are present. So it's a little bit of a weaker protection, which means it's easier for an attacker to take advantage of, but it's still way better than not having it at all.
Well, and it seems like that if you're going to try to apply LLVM, you know, those approaches to a project, it's virtually impossible, right? So do you think Microsoft made that decision to make it a little bit less effective but easier to implement because it's just what's possible right now?
You know, I think that Microsoft has had a long time to think about this, and they've gone through this process with previous mitigations like DEP, ASLR, SafeSEH, and through the Visual Studio development cycle for, you know, a decade now. So it probably, the user experience probably ranks higher on their list of priorities than what the Google Chrome team was after, really, when they contributed Clang CFI to LLVM. You know, they have a different mindset that they're approaching this with. They have engineers that spend every, you know, hour of the day focusing on security inside Chrome. And they can take the time to figure out all those different issues that might crop up in a stronger system that they've implemented.
But if you're an enterprise who's written some sort of custom C++ thing that just is used in your organization, you know, some sort of sprawling crapware that, that has been gradually added to here and there, I'm guessing that the control guard approach, control flow guard approach from Microsoft is going to be your only option, basically.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, what we've learned is that for a lot of software out there, control flow integrity is not the silver bullet that many people thought it might be, simply due to deployment concerns. And that was news to us. We've been recommending these things for a while, but I think it's really incumbent upon security engineers in general in the industry to dog food more of the solutions that they pitch to developers to use.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting thing, right? Because you guys don't, you know, I don't really consider Trailer Bits to be a, you know, like a code auditing company. You know, you really more are around the sort of secure engineering, right? Which is actually trying to design these projects or assist the design of them to make them more secure, which is a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we have about half the team that's dedicated to security assessment and about half the team that's dedicated to security engineering. So we try and do both. You don't want to do all or you know, neither of these things. I think it's really important to, that they each contribute to each other.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't want to be one of those smug bastards who just writes on a report, oh, you should do this, without actually knowing what's involved. I mean, will this sort of little thought experiment, will that actually change the recommendations that you make? I mean, will they get more nuanced?
Yeah, absolutely. Every single one of these pieces of knowledge kind of filters into a report or some kind of guidance that we give to clients that we have, where now we know, we can offer a straighter line path to protecting the code base that you're working with, because we know the pitfalls that are present once you start developing on it. The resource requirement, what you have to do next after you get that document is really key for us, because the recommendations we make don't mean anything unless it results in the code becoming safer later on.
Yeah.
So having the information to do that is really important for us. And these kinds of investigations are one way that we do it.
Yeah, I seem to remember a few pen testers, just a few, might have mentioned something about just changing the date on their reports when they get brought in to do the test the same organization year after year after year. Now, look, another thing you've been working on is called Mxema. That's Mxsema, which is what you call a binary lifter. And this is an interesting idea. I mean, you can actually take something that's compiled, a compiled binary, and sort of reverse it into some sort of intermediate language. The idea being that you can then recompile it, maybe with some different compiler options, and you've actually made it work, which a lot of people said you couldn't really do. So that's kind of cool. Tell us about Mxema.
Yeah, sure. So it was originally a DARPA-funded research project, and it began life as a research project. Tons of warts all over. It only worked on toy programs. It was kind of buggy. The only people that really knew how to use Mxema were people that worked at Trailbits. Well, fast forward now 3 years later, and we've invested a huge amount of effort to making this a production quality tool. And we can do things like, you know, as of last week, we're capable of taking a complicated binary like Apache, lifting it back to LLVM IR, and then recompiling it with different options, with different security protections, and the resulting binary still serves web pages. So it's becoming an option for people that want to do more complicated analyses and they only have binary code to deal with.
So, I mean, I'm imagining this is only really going to be useful to people who are doing vulnerability and exploit research though, right?
Well, so we've had a bunch of clients ask us to identify things like backdoors inside of binary code that gets shipped from third-party vendors that they have to run. You'd be surprised how many people developing embedded systems today work with contract development teams and just get asked to trust binaries that get shipped into devices that, you know, you might have in your house. And then there are, large tech companies that run data centers that have SCADA equipment or, you know, you name it. There's a lot of different pathways for binary software to creep into an organization that you might want to answer questions about. And we can provide very high fidelity analysis tools because we have this unique capability with Mxema.
Okay, but like, is the idea behind Mxema, I mean, in that instance, I'd imagine the idea, you know, the thing that makes it useful there is you get somewhat readable code out of the reversing procedure. And I'm guessing that the ability to recompile is almost just proof that it works, right? It's not really actually so much of a useful thing to be able to recompile a binary.
Yeah, so I think it's the stretch goal to get a recompiled binary that works perfectly identically to, the original thing. It's better for analysis. And I'll give you an example. So what you can do is you can use any tool that depends on LLVM IR that works with the LLVM compiler suite you can use on a binary now. So libfuzzer is a great example. Libfuzzer is a lot like AFL. It's a coverage-guided fuzzer. And in general, it only works on code that you have source code for. But with Mxema, we can actually lift the binary back to that internal compiler state, add in the coverage-guided stuff, and then let libfuzzer run on that binary code. So like you said before, yes, this is absolutely useful for vulnerability research, absolutely useful for helping people find bugs in software and assess the security of it. If you have tools that you've invested in that work on LLVM, then Mxema lets you gain access to those tools for all your binaries. You no longer need source code. So if you're interested in learning more about Mxema, you should join the Empire Hacking Slack. We have a great community of people that have used it for, like, we have this guy from the University of Illinois that's writing a master's thesis on it. And there's other people that are trying to integrate Mixema together with Cli. So if this is an area of research that you're interested in or a tool that you think you might want to use, join our little Slack chat and hit us up.
Where do people find that?
Okay. The best place to find that is on the Mixema GitHub repository. There's a link to join.
And is Mixema an open source tool?
Yes. So we've been great at getting buy-in from our government sponsors to open source almost all the code that we work on for them. So I'm really happy to have the ability to publish so many of the tools that we use on our GitHub.
Now, of course, Infiltrate is coming up soon. Trailer Bits, you guys are going to have 17 people there. And you're giving away mugs. I understand you're giving away mugs. No Ginsu knives just yet, Dan, but people can come and see a Trailer Bits staffer and get a mug. Is that right?
Yeah, so Infiltrate's probably our favorite conference. Put a little blog, talking about why that is. Single track, single topic is how I like to run conferences myself when I do them. So really happy to be part of Infiltrate running the same way. We are bringing with us the final component of our Cyber Grand Challenge robot that we have not open sourced yet. It's called Manticore, and it's a Python symbolic execution framework that powered some of our vulnerability finding capability. So kind of like the NOP, if you find us or any of the 18 people that are with me and ask for early access to it, I will hand it to you. And if you can solve one of a couple different challenges, then you will win yourself a mug.
Fantastic.
So come find anybody. Yeah, come find anybody from Trailbits and ask for access to Manticore, and we'll let you check it out.
Okay, Dan Guido, thank you very much for joining us on this week's show, and indeed thank you for sponsoring this week's episode of Risky Business. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
Cool, thanks.
That was Dan Guido there. Big thanks to Trail of Bits for sponsoring this week's show. I've got massive respect for Trail of Bits. They do really, really good work. So if you need some very large brains to help you out with some project, or you need some security testing of a complicated project and it needs to be a cut above, do get in touch with them via trailofbits.com. TrailofBits.com. And that is it for this week's show. But before we go, it is time to hear from Jake Davis. He hasn't been on the show in a little while, and I'll let him explain his absence in a moment. I will be back in a couple of days with a soapbox special from our good friends at Sanrio. Please do tune in for that. Not sure whether or not we're doing a weekly show next week, just weather dependent. Basically, I will have either next week or the week after off. So yes, may or may not be back next week. But until then, until a couple of days from now with the Sanrio special, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Hello there, Risky Business audience. You may have noticed I've been away for a couple of weeks. That's because I've been scouring the CIA files. Not Vault 7. No WikiLeaks nonsense. We're talking real secret shit. For example, we all know the CIA backdoors computer parts. They've been backdooring keyboards. Actual keyboards. Not in the way you think. They can tell if you're a terrorist by how much sweat comes off of your fingertips while you type, and what keys you use, how you type it. And they took that method and they advanced it to detect follicles in your hand. And then they took it even further. They want to detect follicles in your scalp. And so shampoo, 95% of shampoo brands, CIA backdoors. You put it in your hair, you rub it about, in goes the code, straight away. It's in there forever. You can chop all your hair off, it's in the scalp. You can RM your face, it doesn't matter. Look, the Super Mario level, the water one, the glitchy one, failed CIA backdoor. It's a cover-up. They've been backdooring metaphysical concepts. If you think of what something is or where it belongs or why it's there, it's backdoored. And I think the most heinous of all, air itself. We all like air. We like to breathe it. It's fantastic. And we all know that things pass through air. And the CIA knows that too. And so they've developed a way to harness sound, to capture other sound in the air so that it doesn't pass through it. It goes straight into the CIA. Just everything. Every sound just goes straight there. Space-time backdoor. Now, WikiLeaks were too cowardly to publish this. They submitted demands to various philosophers and shampoo manufacturers, and they didn't comply. It's all been kept secret. I'm revealing it to you now, exclusively, at my own risk. at my own risk, we know the shampoo brands and the water distilleries and the philosophers and the creators of Super Mario and are all behind this, and they're all complicit, and we know they're taking a hefty chunk of change for it. And you know what? I'm not going to stand for it. Everyone should be able to play Super Mario without fear of having their nudes leaked. So please, stop shampooing your hair, stop breathing air, and don't think anymore.